Welcome to the Thursday session of our conference. I'm John Chambers. I'm going to moderate this session. And when I was first at Bell Labs in the Statistics Research Department around 50 years ago, a topic of lunchtime conversation quite frequently was the deplorable state of teaching statistics. In our opinion, even in the most prestigious departments, it tended to be a set of rigid procedures backed by mathematics that was more or less interesting, and with only the most tenuous relationship to the difficult process of actually learning from data. So from time to time, we threatened to do something about this, like write a book or something of that sort, and hardly anything came of it. So this morning, we have the opportunity and the privilege to hear from someone who has most definitely done something about it, including writing a book. Professor Nolan has made important contributions in research and teaching and administration at the University of California in Berkeley, but in my opinion, I can't think of a topic more relevant for the future of statistics, for the future of science indeed, than the one she's addressing us on today, statistical thinking and data science. Deb?
Well, thank you, John, for that very nice introduction. And his introduction essentially summed up my talk, so maybe we can go have coffee. So I can't start with I can't start with a talk on statistical thinking and data science without providing at least one definition of data science. And I particularly like the one that Ian Johnstone and Roberts from their 2014 NSF report talk about: the computational aspects of carrying out a complete data analysis. And by complete, they mean the acquisition of the data, the management of the data, and the analysis, and also the reporting of the data. And I would describe this as a blend or an integration of computational thinking and statistical thinking. And as a little shout out, the ASA came up last year with published last year, a new set of guidelines for the undergraduate statistics curriculum. So if you're interested, take a look at that. This effort was led by Nick Horton, and it was a privilege to serve on that committee as well. And over a course of a year with lots of webinars and getting input from the statistics community, we produced this document, which I think you might find of interest. So, rather than start with me telling you about the different approaches to incorporating statistical thinking into data science, I thought maybe we would have a little thought moment, a little discussion among each other when you consider this question. So, think about the typical instructional practices in our field, and what would you like to see changed? And I am going to then go through five things that I would like to see changed. And I'll say right now that I've put in little cartoon characters and I've really pushed the point. And hopefully I won't offend anyone in this room. And I'll say now that I have also been the subject of some of these practices in our fields. So just take a moment, talk to your partner, sip your coffee, and think about what practices in teaching statistics. If you're a student now, what's happened in your classes? If you're a professor, what ways have you taught a class that you really would like to change? And if you're out in industry, you can think back to your training and think of a couple things. So I'll give you 2 minutes to do that.
Thank you.
That generated a lot of conversation. I guess there are lots of things that you'd like to see changed. Does anybody want to shout out one or two, or shall I just tell you mine? I'll just tell you mine. Okay. And first of all, a lot of introductory statistics classes take a statistical study, condense it into one paragraph where you read that, and then you're asked, so what went wrong with this study? And you think about this sort of catchphrases of, well, there's correlation does not imply causation, and statistical significance doesn't imply importance. And you kind of learn some catchphrases, and you sort of pick between them, and that's your statistics training. Has anybody experienced that? Yes. Yeah. Okay. Then there's the canned data approach, where this is often, I think maybe this has something to do with my gender, but I think of it as there's canned data in a can opener as opposed to the nail and the hammer. And you're given one new method. You're taught a new method, and you're given a set of data that's all nicely prepared for you to apply that method to, and you apply it and produce your analysis. So in other words, you open the can, you pour out the contents, warm it up, stir it, and serve it, and that's your data analysis. Anybody experience that one? Yes, okay. All right, next one. EDA is for babies. The time when we see ADA is in our intro stat class, when you can take a pencil and draw or write out a stem and leaf plot. And after that, you get to the theory. Theory is for grown-ups. You don't worry about EDA anymore. That's the last you do any of the EDA type of analysis in your advanced classes. That was definitely the case for me. I don't know about anybody out there. Yes? Okay. Another one. This is a set of dance steps, and the idea is that, you know, the computing part, just, we don't need to teach the computing part. That's just easy stuff. Give them a template, a set of guidelines, and maybe they'll change a variable name, or they'll swap in a different procedure or something like that. But if they follow through these steps, well, like that, they'll be able to analyze the data. So the computational part in a course is often relegated to the section, not the laboratory section, not part of the actual class meeting. And every semester, every course will have a quick review where they just give you templates and you kind of catch up, but you never really understand what you're doing. The students remain confused and frustrated with using the computer, and that's their experience with doing data analysis. Have people experienced that one? Yeah, okay, a few of you. And the last one is the centerpiece of the statistics course is the normal curve. Right there is the center of statistics. Our statistics classes tend to rely solely on mathematics and the normal theory that goes behind making approximations so that we can do t-tests and z-tests and a little bit of simple linear regression. And then when you get to the advanced course, there's still a lot of normal theory and often not much else. So those are my five complaints about the sort of typical statistics education. I will say now that of course things are changing. A lot of this is moving to a new way of teaching statistics, and I've basically just made little caricatures of traditional ways of teaching statistics. But I'd say that we really do need to make a greater effort, and we need to update our instructional practice. And what I'm going to talk to you about today is some of the things that I've done in my classes and other things I've been involved in for trying to bring data and the data experience and data science more integrated into statistics education. And there are two quotes here that I'd like to read to you, because I think one was 30 years ago and I think it's incredibly relevant, and the other is a dozen years ago and is also incredibly relevant about why we need to update our instructional practice. So Terry Speed, in speaking to the International Conference on Teaching Statistics in 1986, said, "In the beginning, we taught mathematics and then called it statistics. Much of it was probability. Then, with the help of computers, we started to teach data analysis and statistical modeling. This was fine, apart from one feature. It was largely context-free." So that's not unlike some of the issues that I raised earlier, but it's saying that what's really the exciting and interesting about statistics is that you're solving problems within a context. There's a scientific question, and you're trying to answer that question and figure out how statistics can appropriately answer that question. And then Brad Efron at the JSM in San Francisco in 2003 was on a panel about teaching statistics. And he said the rather bold statement is, "Traditional statistics courses do not attempt to teach what we do, and certainly not why we do it. These courses are caught in a time warp that bores teachers and consequently bores students." And I think that reflects on the time warp of, let's say, the 1950s and 60s, when we did rely a lot on normal theory for developing our statistical methods. So, some suggestions. Why don't we provide open-ended problems, not canned problems, that have a context? So you're thinking about how are you going to answer this problem, what statistics are you going to bring to bear that can answer the question? How about having students experience the complete data analysis process? Complete meaning from data acquisition, data preparation, transformation of variables, so they'll have a better sense of understanding what it is they're doing, and give them practice in this process of statistical thinking as well. Conducting modern EDA, meaning EDA not with a pencil and paper, but EDA with a computer, throughout the entire data analysis process. You'll see a cycle of, I think of it as a process, but a lot of people think of it as a cycle of data analysis where you acquire your data, then you do EDA, then you go on to modeling and reporting. And I think of EDA as being throughout that entire cycle or process. And it's time we put some attention on the core computational paradigms of whatever language that we're using in solving our problems, so that our students are better able to solve new problems in the future. And let's free statistical theory from normal theory. So those are the ideas about suggestions for how we go about changing how we teach. And essentially, it says, let's infuse the statistics curriculum with data science, and this will make our students better statisticians. All right, so here's five concrete examples that I'd like to go through, and they are really quite different types of examples. One's a project case study. Another is a way of how an instructor might interact with students. One's a homework assignment. Others are classroom activities. So I'm trying to give you a range of different ways of bringing data science, statistical thinking together in a course. So I'll go through each of these. The first one's a full case study, and I'll focus on that first part, data access, cleaning, and transformation. The next one is something that I discovered when running the explorations and statistics research workshops for about 6 years with Mark Hansen and Duncan Temple Lang, of a really nice way of integrating doing modern applied statistics in a setting where it's all focused on EDA, but you can still learn a lot about statistical thinking and about applied problems. Some classroom programming activities, a critique and composition of visualization as a homework assignment, and putting the three R's into theoretical statistics. And I'll leave you to guess about what those three R's are until we get there. Okay, the first one is this, by the way, is a little plug for a book that Duncan Temple Lang and I have recently published. It has contributions. It's a kind of written and edited volume. It has contributions from others, and there are a set of case studies for trying to teach computational reasoning and problem solving in R. One of those is looking at indoor positioning systems. So all of us have our cell phones, and there are the access points that are in a building. And this is a particular floor plan for a building at the University of Mannheim. And at there's the problem or the question is, how can we use the strength of those signals that are picked up at the access points in order to locate the person with the cell phone or the piece of equipment in a hospital or the product in a warehouse? So it's, that's why it's an indoor positioning system. And so to try and answer that question about what, how can we use these signal strengths from the various access points to go back and locate something, someone, an experiment was carried out where you can see these, these little gray circles are 166 locations where someone went around and collected data. At each one of these locations, that person rotated in eight orientations. So it's one, two, three, all the way around. And measurements were taken at these access points and other access points. These square blocks are the access points. So that is the test data, the training data. And then there was test data, and that's when locations were chosen at random and orientations at random and measurements were taken. And those are the black circles. And so the question is, okay, how do we go about answering this question? And the first thing is to look at the data. This is four records from the data. The first three start with a pound sign, and the next record is very long and doesn't fit all on one line of my PowerPoint. And so that's a bit of a challenge for a student. Most of you would say, oh yeah, that's not a problem. The student doesn't even know how to look at these data, right? You can't open it in Word. What kind of software do you use to look at the data? That's a question that they need to, or a problem they need to overcome. Once they do that, the question are those pound signs or number signs only at the top, and they're not. They're scattered throughout, and that those are not data. Those need to be discarded. So it's not just skip the first three lines, but you have to skip any lines throughout the whole file that start with pound signs. The next is, if you take a look at one of these records, if you can actually focus on it, there's a MAC address, an equal sign, then the signal, which is a negative 38 in this case, then some other number, then a comma, then another number, and a semicolon. So there are three delimiters here, the semicolon, the comma, and the equal sign. And each of them are separators for different pieces of data. And some of this data we don't really need, and others we do. And so it's not your typical extraction. Also, the rows are different lengths. We have, we have a ragged array here. One record turns into many observations. So once we are able to read that data in, we have to clean the data. How do we clean the data? Well, I said there are eight locations, or eight orientations. How do we validate that? We can make a plot, and we find that there are nine. And that's because the orientations aren't exact. And so something around zero is also something around, might be around 360. And so we have to fix that. We look at the MAC addresses. We're told there were six. There are more than that. So we have to figure out, and we don't know. There's no connection. There's the map, and there are the MAC addresses. We're not told which one corresponds to which. There are too many, and we need to figure out how to eliminate them. And we need to know what's the distance between an access point and the actual location where the measurement was taken. So we could possibly make a heat map, and if any of you were at the heat map talk yesterday, which was quite good, you'll know this is these are terrible colors. We can make a heat map to figure out where are the really hot spots to then connect the MAC address to the actual location so we can compute distances. So what I've done is, all I've done so far is read in the data, clean the data, and prepare it for analysis. And in that process, we use different technologies, a little bit of regular expressions, figuring out a little bit of EDA. And so the students are closer to the data source. They understand the data better and how to derive variables. They use EDA in these steps. And then later on, they're not done yet, they choose a technique, a statistical method, which is what most courses focus on. And we use things that are more computational, like nearest neighbors. and then use cross-validation. And the point is, there are many different approaches, and it's open-ended. Number two, there's an example that came from the Explorations in Statistics Research Workshop. This was Carrie Grimes from Google came. She spent 2 days with students, and basically their skill set, there was no preparation, very little statistics, and the focus was entirely on EDA. And so there's a cycle here of, there's a really wonderful exchange back and forth between the instructor, which was Carrie, and the students. So she would discuss something with them, send them off to do EDA, visualizations, whatever, be really creative with how you might want to answer this question with a visualization, then parade your results. So they'd come back and we'd have what I call now in my classes, a plot parade, where we show some really nice plots that then fuel the discussion, which goes on to, again, more exploration. So here's the example. It's about keeping a web cache fresh. There was an experiment where thousands or hundreds of thousands of websites, hundreds of thousands of websites were selected, and they were pinged every hour for 30 days to see if they'd changed from the time before. So the top line is an example, those green dots of when the website might have actually changed. And the blue ones are, on the bottom line, are when we actually observed a change. And so you see that when there was one change in the hour between when we were there last, we detect it. But when there are two changes, like here, all we know is that at least one thing changed. And when nothing happened, we know that nothing happened in that hour. So I have a little bit of issue with not observing the actual data we'd like to observe, which is, when did things change? We only observe them at hourly intervals. So they're sent off to explore the data. Just think of ways to look at the data. Here's some rug plots of just 5 of them. And immediately you uncover issues with the data. The black triangles are when the observation stopped, even though they were supposed to go for the full 30 days. Some of them were rather regular, changed a lot. Others only changed 3 times at the very end. And so you can see that there are a lot of different ways that websites can change. They can regularly update. They might hardly ever change at all. This one's probably a professor's website. Mine would probably be totally empty, right? So from that, we lead into talking about the Poisson process and how the Poisson process might describe the first three of those and not others. And then talk about what are the assumptions that go into the process. There's one other exploration, looking at how long it was observed and the number of changes. And from there, you can also detect things like what I just described. Then they can be sent off again to explore the assumptions in the possible model. And here would be, does the rate of change according to the time of day or day of week? And you can aggregate your data. This is There we go. You can aggregate your data. And you see that this clearly must be Saturday and Sunday. But to do that aggregation, we had to select we don't have the actual times, we just have numbers 1, 2, 3 for the hour. And up to whatever the last one of the 30 days. And so we need to select all websites that are in a similar time zone, like all US domain names. So the point is that students can get exposed to a modern problem, and they can be really creative working with the data without getting too hung up. So this is a very different example from the first one, in that there isn't any time spent on preparation and validation. It's more spent in a very creative process of exploration in a cycle where the instructor then gives them maybe new data or talks about a new model, and the cycle continues. The third example I've used as a homework assignment, and I call it critique and compose, or deconstruct and reconstruct. And oftentimes, as statisticians, we're very critical, and it's easy to be critical. And what's hard is to take the next step and figure out, how would I do this better? And I do that in a with a visualization. I have realized that it's hard to teach visualization, and you basically, most courses don't teach it. There might be one course only on visualization, but very little effort is spent on making good plots in our courses. And it's hard to design assignments where you can sort of get students, push them to a certain level, or see if they're really understanding what they're doing. And I really like this assignment. Jamie Parrott and I have recently published an article where we have about 5 different types of assignments we've developed for teaching visualization. Given we're in an election year, I thought this is a particularly fun one to look at. And I'm going to have you guys, since you're statisticians, you're very critical, I'm going to ask you, how would you improve this plot? And I'm not going to say anything about it. This was taken from a website that no longer is live. And just take a look at it. I'll give you, again, 2 minutes. And take a look at it and see if you can come up with, you can easily come up with 6 things wrong with this plot. But I'll let you loose. And this time I will ask you what you discovered.
Thank you.
I can rest my voice.
Yes.
It sounds like we've reached a consensus, or you've found lots of problems and are ready to just shout it out. What's wrong with this plot? No legend, okay? Meaning what? You don't know what light green and dark green mean. Yeah, that's right. Which one? So you do know enough. You're bringing enough to know. This is the U.S. There's two bars. It's probably Democrat and Republican. Is that right? Is that what you're saying? Oh, it actually does say Democrat and Republican. Yes, you don't know which is which. What else is a problem in the back? The tick marks on the plot on the x-axis are every 5 years. That's when we elect presidents, right? Yeah. Right? Yeah, they're, it's nuts. What else? Yes. Oh, somebody actually knows something. Maybe I screwed up, actually, because the data originally came only to 2008, and I went and got the rest. So maybe I didn't add right. But tell me what you said. There's an extra county, okay? So, oh, right, this is counties, right? All right, so, and does anybody see those little numbers? Can you see the little numbers on top of the bars? Right, and they add to... 58 or 59 if I screwed up, but let's so it's the same number for the green, the two green bar, the light and the dark add to 58, okay, which is the number of counties in California. All right, so you've done a good job. Here are many of the things I came up with, which you've come up with. But what the heck is that? So here's the next stage. It's really easy, right, to come up with. You guys came up with them really quickly, and then you're, okay, I'm done. The hard part is to say, what do you think this person who made this plot, what point were they trying to make? What was it, and can I do a better job of getting their message out? What was the point of making this plot? Change in trends in voter registration. And this is very good. And this is a really lousy way to do it, right? Because what is the observation? These are counties, but it's people who vote, not counties. And there's a lurking variable back here. If any of you are California residents, you can shout out what you think is problematic with looking at how counties change over time, as opposed to people voting. Something LA versus
Lodoc.
There we go. And the problem with that is population, right? Right. So there are some really small counties and some really large counties, and the small counties tend to be rural, which also tend to be more conservative. And so there's a lurking variable there. Can we improve it? Well, the same website that generated that plot, or they didn't generate it, where the person took the data and made that plot, also has voter registration by county, voter registration for the state by party, and you can remake the plot and get a really different picture. This is party affiliation of registered voters in California, and now the tick marks are the presidential election years, and a really nice little image appears, right? And that is what the first of all, the actual affiliation with a party like Republican and Democrat is on the decline. Republicans maybe slightly more than Democrat, and what's on the rise is people who declined to state or have an affiliation. That was not clear from the first plot, and in fact it looked like the Republicans and the Democrats were sort of neck and neck the whole time. Okay, so I lost my little summary, but that was number three. Number four is focusing on some core computational paradigms, actually trying to teach computing a little bit. And this became an issue for me. I never really thought about it too much until last year when my class size went from 80 to 150. And I realized that I was going to lose people in this, the class that I'll tell you about it at the very end. There are no computing programming prerequisites to this course. And so there are real newbies coming in. And even still, even the computer science students that take this class, maybe they could use a little refresher too, right? It's always good to learn something again in a new environment. And so I started to look through the computer science education literature as to, like, how do you teach important concepts? And came up with, like, a follow the flow diagram that I use in class, which is having simple bits of code and then steps that you would go through. And it's great if you can animate this, and maybe that would be a good thing to work on, is animating the process of one step to the next step to the next step. This is showing the difference between an if else, and if, and which steps are being executed. And I call it follow the flow. You're following the flow, the computational flow. Other things that I've done is there's been a lot of research in computer science education about partners doing partner work, paired work with code review, and I found that can be really quite good. They do it where you review the other person's code. I do it where I hand out everybody, give everybody code that I have written. Much of it is taken from their code that they've given to me, and then we all review the same set of code. Howard Wehner's Dirty Dozen, I took that idea and came up with a set of R coding Dirty Dozen of what things not to do or what things to do to really poorly code. And so there's a greater focus. I think we need to focus more on actually training students to code. Treating coding seriously, focusing on the language and the paradigm of the language, like RS was created by statisticians for statisticians. What are the special features in it, like the data frame and the factor and et cetera, that were created because it's helpful for statisticians to analyze data. And when our students become better at understanding programming, they'll be better at learning new technologies and new programs in the future. So our students will write better code. They'll be able to debug their code more easily if we give them the tools to do that. Okay, the last one, the last example is talking about our theoretical statistics courses. And I say we can, in addition to mathematics, use computing to understand statistics theory. Statistics theory does not have to be always couched or explained in terms of mathematics. Computing can be a very powerful tool for conveying statistical concepts where students can construct their understanding. You can take rules of thumb that, for example, with a chi-square test, you should only apply the chi-square test if there's a certain number of counts in a bin. And you can check that out for different kinds of distributions. It turns out for the uniform, it doesn't do so badly if you break that rule. Simulation is a powerful tool in that regard. Resampling as well. So there's a George Cobb wrote a paper in the Technology and Science, Statistics Education talking about the problem with our statistics courses. He says, what we teach is largely the technical machinery of numerical approximations that are based on the normal distribution and its many subsidiary cogs. This machinery was once necessary, and these days we have no excuse. We need to recognize that the computer revolution in statistics education is far from over. And this is one area where I think there is a lot of movement going on in the traditional statistics classes to bring in the ideas of resampling. Here's one very simple example about, that uses the idea of that uses permutation tests. And for those of you who are students and instructors in the room, I really like this. It's about looking at student evaluations of and the difference in the gender of the instructor and how whether or not the females are rated higher or lower than the males. This was an online course, by the way. This is published by Boring, Ottoboni, and Stark. And Kelly Ottoboni, I just learned yesterday, has an R package that she's just developed. She spoke in a session yesterday. This is one of their data sets that they're using. So there's an online course where the students never met face-to-face with their TAs. There were four sections. The students were randomized into those four sections. Two were taught by a female TA, two were taught by a male TA. But in the female TA's class sections, one of them was identified as the male TA. And in the male's sections, one of his two was identified as the female TA. You got it? Okay. So essentially, you've got sort of a strata of the female TA's sections and the male TA's sections. And you can think of testing their responses on student evaluations. You can actually compare compare how the students rated them. This is on just one question and how promptly they return the assignment. And by the way, they both return the assignments at the same time for all four sections. Okay. So over here is the two left columns are the female TA's sections. And this is their evaluation on promptness on a scale from 1 to 5. The leftmost, the female was identified as being female. The next one, the female was identified as being female. Help me out here. The female was identified as male. Then the two on the left are the male sections. This third column here, he is being identified as the female. And the last column, he's being identified as the male. It's pretty striking, right? Right. Five is good, yes, good point. Five is good. Yes. Right. The only ones to get ones and twos and threes, oh, except for one three, ones, twos, and threes were the those identified as female, with one exception. So we can, given this design, the randomization into the sections, we can develop a permutation test. We can say, okay, what if I'm just flipped all the students, I reallocated them. Presumably, the ones in the two female sections would just have responded the exact same way, whether they thought their TA was female or not. So we randomize within those, the female students, and we randomize the male students within his two sections, each time computing the difference between the male and the female scores. And you see that we'd expect the difference when you do this permutation to be zero. This is what was observed, and it happens, and the chance of that is less than 0.005. So the three R's, randomize, repeat, reject. What I really like about this is that it focuses on statistical thinking to derive the probability model that you're going to use to carry out your test. So normal theory isn't sort of mucking up the understanding of the statistical concepts here. You can do this with bootstrapping, and by the way, Tim Hesterberg recently published in the TAS of mistakes that are, one is how to teach bootstrapping in introductory and advanced undergraduate courses, what gotchas to be aware of. It's a really nice paper. There are already books out by the Five Locks and by Alan Rossman and collaborators on teaching with sampling-based or simulation-based or resampling-based inference. But bootstraps and permutation tests are in really nice ways that we can now do use in our classroom to introduce these concepts without relying on the mathematical theory. But they do require computational skills. So the students are going to have some level, and depending on what course you're in, there's a lot of there are a lot of functions, like the Mosaic project, have sort of simplified that process for introductory courses, and then for the more advanced classes where you want to focus on computation, you can have the students writing their own tests. All right, so those are the five examples, and I'd like to now just wrap up really quickly with running through just some of the nitty-gritty details of a course that Duncan Temple Lang and I co-developed when he left Bell Labs about 12 or 13 years ago. He went to UC Davis, and he and I taught this course. We developed it and taught it for the first time about a dozen years ago. Since then, there have been lots of other really great classes, and I would say actually before then as well. And the article, Data Science and Statistics Curricula, Preparing Students to Think with Data by Hardin et al., outlines six or seven approaches. Ben Baumers has an article talking about his course at Smith. And at Berkeley now, just this last year, we've worked on developing a new course that's co-taught by computer scientists and statisticians and faculty from the School of Information for the very, very intro level. So this course is not at the intro level, but there are no requirements. So there is no statistics requirement. There is no programming requirement to take this course. And it is part of the statistics major. It's a core piece. All stat majors take three courses and then electives after that. Those three courses are concepts in probability, concepts in statistics, concepts in computing with data. And this is the course I'm talking about. We started, there we go, in 2004 with 40 students, and last year, actually the year before, we had 650, and now we're just restricted by resources. As I mentioned before, there are no prereqs, but we do look for students who are at least sophomores because it's a very intensive class. The students come from all sorts of areas, mostly statistics, math, and engineering, but also from other areas as well. So I just want to briefly tell you what the philosophy and the goals of the course are, and then talk about how it's a, and you see one of the philosophies is to braid together data technologies, statistical thinking, and programming. And I'd like to go through the topic, each of those briefly, and tell you what the topics we cover in each of those three areas are. So the philosophy is that we present authentic problems within a scientific context. The students work very closely with the original data, meaning as close to original as seems feasible. We want them to use a computer expressively to conduct their statistical analysis. You know, think visualization, EDA. I mentioned already the three braided strands of data technologies, statistical thinking, and programming. And we want them to see the broad array of well-tested code or well-designed code software that's out there and to use that as opposed to maybe more traditional statistical computing classes where you learn about the algorithms for inverting matrices and then write your own linear model program. And lastly, we want to model for them how to learn new technologies. The statistical concepts include basic statistical literacy, talking about variability, data reduction, the method of comparison. We spend quite a bit of time on graphics, the elements and principles of graphing. The statistical methods that we introduce are a bit on the ad hoc side in that there's no, it depends on the particular problems the students are working on, and we use methods that have a nice algorithmic explanation, such as classification trees, et cetera, and they also see simulation tools like cross-validation, the bootstrap, and Monte Carlo method. The computational concepts focus, we actually teach them within R. We teach them function writing, control flow environments, how to debug, how to test, efficiency. And I used to, but now that the class is bigger, also teach them a little bit of event-driven programming. And the information technologies are, since so much of the data that we analyze now originate from text, we look at regular expressions and pattern matching, string manipulation. They analyze data that's in a relational database. They look at hierarchical data, such as XML data. They're exposed to shell tools and other data formats. And we do all of this within R, because R is, as you know, R is a great way to be able to access a database and write SQL commands from within R to use regular expressions and transform text data into data you can analyze from within R, to look at XML data and use XPath to extract information from all from within R. So that's essentially the course, and I'd like to stop now and see if you have any questions, but essentially, again, to repeat that it's time to embrace these new paradigms for how we are able to educate our students. And if we do this integration, then our students will have the essential skills that they need to engage in collaborative work in the future. They'll have the confidence that they need to take on new tasks as new technologies evolve, to learn how to use them and use them in their work, and to engage in and succeed at statistical inquiry. Thank you.
Wow, that was terrific. Questions, and please, would you raise your hand if you want to ask a question? We have microphones around the room, and if you could possibly go to a microphone to ask your question. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this talk. I cannot agree more, but there are two things that I encounter in practical courses. One is, this needs more time, and the second is, not all students like project-oriented courses. For them, it's easier to learn things by heart and forget it after the examination. Yeah? And this is much more demanding, and not all students will be our friends if you do it this way. So how can we overcome these two problems, time limitation and motivation?
Can you say a little more about time limitation? I'm not sure what you mean by that. You mean you lose time in the classroom, or it just takes too much time?
I teach statistics in classroom for very different people. Some like it this way, and some others don't. Because they are used to learn things by heart.
Right.
And project-oriented requires own thinking from the beginning.
Yeah, and I guess my response is, like, that's good, and we need to change, because they're in the real world. They're not going to be able to memorize the answers. And on the other hand, I will say, when I first started using case studies in my theoretical math class, I had, and so this was, I guess, 20 years or so ago. Not with this level of computation, but still they were doing data analyses. They were open-ended projects with Terry Speed. And I had students who were math majors who could take this course to satisfy the math requirement. And they came up to me and pounded on my desk and said, this isn't statistics. This isn't a mathematical statistics. you're making us do data analysis. And it's like, yeah, because you don't understand the theory without actually putting it to practice. And that happened 20 years ago, but since then, everybody and most people in my department now teach that way, and the students accept it. So I find, yeah, there'll be pushback when you change, but the rewards in the making that change far outweigh the issues. And on the flip side, you say some students like it, some don't. Well, the same is true for the way you're currently teaching. Some students like it and some don't. And my guess is the ones who don't are quiet because this is the way they think you learn statistics.
So if we bring this down to the high school level, I have a daughter that's going to be taking AP statistics class, but clearly I'm not going to be able to change the AP program all by myself. So has anyone developed any adjunct activities that one could bring into those classrooms?
Well, let me first address your first statement that there's no movement in the AP stat.
I didn't say that. I said I wouldn't be able to make any changes.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Very well qualified. So then informational only is that the AP stat is looking to make changes. The APCS just did a huge redo of their topic, and the statisticians are looking to also redo AP stat, and they have talked to a few statisticians to sort of say, what are your expectations now at the college level? How should we be teaching AP stat? So I don't know how fast those things change, but they do. And to get to your second question is, with the AP, there's the exam happens, let's say, in April or March or something, and then there's this period after that where there's a lot of flexibility in what the instructor can teach. And from my experience, really good instructors take that time to then do no longer having to teach to the test, to sort of open it up and do projects in that 1 to 2 months left before the end of the year. And so I think that's a great place to enter. And there's the ASA is now having sort of mini conferences within the JSM for high school and middle school teachers for statistics. And I think there's room in there there are a few high school teachers who use R in their classroom. And I think if this community can support that, that would be amazing. Yeah.
Actually, I'm amazed that you are able to teach all these topics because time is an issue. But let's think big and let's actually think what else one could put in. Mm-hmm. I think you're missing two things. One is actually generating your own data through designed experiments. You're still giving people, yep, you know, bigger, yeah, data sets which they have to manipulate. But I didn't see anything where they actually go out and create their own data.
Yeah.
The second point is, at the end, you know, it's not just enough to do the statistical analysis. You also have to be able to put it in words. So there ought to be an interaction of the statistical part with the writing part. I think that's another piece which, you know, we are missing in the education.
Yeah, thank you very much for bringing up those two points. And let me address the second one first. And that is that I neglected to say that we actually do have students write reports in this class. And right now they're using R Markdown. Well, it depends on the assignment. If the assignment is a large data analysis, they're using R Markdown and writing. I've got limitations on number of pages and that sort of thing, but they actually write reports. And I agree, I can't agree more with you that the whole communication is part of the piece, that piece. And then for the question about the design of experiments is really good as well. In this course in particular, the focus is more on the computational side of things. And so indeed, we analyze the data coming from experiments, but do not create data. We have a class for design of experiments where students do that, where they design and carry out their own two-cubed or something like that experiment, which is a lot of fun for them, and they learn a whole lot in that process.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time. I know we could go on for another hour. That was an absolutely phenomenal talk, Deb. Thank you so much.
Thank you.